Before we get into this broadcast on fingerprints, what I'd like you to do is take a moment and take a look at your hands, palm side up. And what you'll see on the fingers and the palms are lines. We call them ridge lines. They're also called friction ridges. And did you know that of the billions and billions of people on the face of the earth, nobody has the same fingerprints? Absolutely nobody. The science of fingerprints and its various applications is arguably the most valuable weapon in the arsenal of police investigators and has solved more crimes than any other process. I know this firsthand because I've solved everything from a simple break and enter to a second-degree murder using fingerprints. Law enforcement around the world is now approaching its second century of using fingerprints as a primary crime-fighting tool. But it was a serious flaw in another identification system that led to the adoption of fingerprints as the world standard that is still in use today. Later in the 19th century, a records clerk in the Prefecture of Police in France, Alphonse Bertillon, decided he did not like the way police records were being maintained. He was not happy with the way the criminals were being identified and decided to introduce a comparison system based on body and head measurements. Each time a criminal was taken into custody, a series of measurements were taken based on such things as the distance between his nose and ears, length of his arms, and weight. It was called a Bertillon signaletic system. In 1883, Bertillon identified the first repeat offender, and by the next year, he had identified 241 criminals using his unique scientific method. The world of policing and records keeping had changed forever. Unfortunately for Alphonse, not all police took their measuring duties seriously. Different measurements were taken of the same criminal at different times. Child criminals grew up and adult criminals grew older. Arms and legs got longer in the children, while elderly criminals shrunk in height. Matching measurements on file became increasingly difficult, and a number of people were wrongfully identified. And of course, Mr. Bertillon had to deal with police officers who back in the 1800s were not exactly models of efficiency and loyalty to the company. They kind of tended to take their job a little less seriously. So you were seeing mistakes being made in the measurements and the observations done by these Bertillon operators. A famous 1903 case of mistaken identity in the United States using Bertillon's system led to its demise as a method of recording criminal activity. All was not lost, however. The legacy of Bertillon's identification system still allows police to photograph and take measurements, height and weight, of persons who may be fingerprinted according to whatever Identification of Criminals Act is present in your jurisdiction. In other words, mugshots and descriptions, physical descriptors, tattoos, obvious scars, anything that you would observe being present on the person in custody. The only possession a person will ever own that belongs to them and no one else is their fingerprint identity. Has determined that fingerprints are formed while an unborn child is still in the womb and remain the same even after death. It is this uniqueness that has been recognized for thousands of years. A trade contract on a Sumerian clay tablet dating back to 2000 BC was found to have been completed using finger impressions. A scientific study in 1684, believe it or not, was done by a British scientist, Dr. Nehemiah Grew. He completed an intense study of the skin and described the pores and ridges, friction ridges, found on the tips of fingers, palms, and soles of the feet. Remember when you looked at your fingers and palms And what you saw were these friction ridges, but you also saw little tiny holes in them. They're called sweat pores. And the sweat pores allow the body to release excess moisture, excess chemicals, this type of thing. A cross-section diagram of the human skin, especially in the fingers and the palms, will show that there are several surfaces of skin present. Now, the top layer is called the epidermis. That's where the friction ridges are located, and that's where you can see the holes of the sweat glands. The next layer is called the dermal layer. Located in the dermal layer are things called the duct of sweat glands. So in other words, this is where the sweat and the water collects. And then from these glands, it passes up through tubes, through the sweat pores, and out onto the epidermis. As an evidence examiner, you have to be aware that the epidermal layer, if it's cut, will not scar. It'll heal over. But if the cut is deep enough and down into the dermal layer, then there'll be a scar. And on the actual epidermis, you'll see a puckering around where the scar has formed after healing has taken place. And quite often, these are great roadmaps for discovering who your bad guy might be. There's a story about a bank robber back in the 1930s who got so frustrated because he kept getting caught because he left his fingerprints at the scene of a bank robbery. So he went to a doctor and had the doctor actually graft his fingers onto his chest. And once the healing had taken place, then the graft was cut away and there were no more friction ridges. However, the fingerprints were so unique that as soon as the examiner saw the marks that had been left behind, they knew who had done the crime. Now, it is the friction ridges and the sweat pores that play a major part in fingerprint technology. Modern instrumental chemical analysis has revealed that sweat is approximately 99 to 99.5% water, with the remaining 0.5 to 1.0% being solids. But half of the solids are organic substances and one half inorganic salts. The predominant inorganic salt is sodium chloride, in other words, ordinary salt. The organic substances include a variety of acids and nitrogenous compounds, the most important of which for fingerprint technicians are amino acids. Remember when I talked about billions of people on the earth and none of them have the same fingerprints? So that's kind of pretty daunting. Scientists came to the rescue again and they discovered that of all those billions of fingerprints, there's only 8 distinct fingerprint patterns. They're loop, a radial loop, an arch, a tented arch, a double loop, a whorl, a center pocket loop, and an accidental. And we don't know what the accidental is. It's usually consisting of several fingerprint patterns, but you so very rarely see that type of pattern in a fingerprint that you don't really pay too much attention to it. I can remember one time when I did pay attention to a fingerprint, and it was early on in my career in the forensics unit. And what I did was I had to go to a break and enter at a movie theater. And this particular movie theater had the candy counter at the front, and then in behind the candy counter was a storeroom where the thieves had evidently gone in and helped themselves to candy, chocolate bars, and anything else that was stored inside the storage room. So I looked around, and I happened to spot a chocolate bar sitting on the floor. Now, the chocolate bar had been opened. It was one of these big, big chocolate bars you get in the theaters. And I looked a little closer at it, and here was a fingerprint in the chocolate. It's called a plastic fingerprint now, but the friction ridges had embedded themselves right into the chocolate. So now what am I going to do? I was new to the job, and I know you couldn't put fingerprint powder and dust up the chocolate bar and come up with an impression. So I just gathered it up, put it into a cardboard box, and brought it back to the office. Now, none of the guys had ever seen anything like this before, so we put our heads together and we decided to take a picture of the fingerprint. So the picture was taken, and then we made a life-size fingerprint. Now, he couldn't preserve the chocolate bar forever, so it went into the garbage. However, one of our fingerprint technicians, a sergeant, took a look at the fingerprint, and he started searching through all the files. Now, you remember all the files were divided up into 8 different patterns, and we were able to see on the pattern on the chocolate bar that it was a loop pattern. So he went into the files, and he took out individual fingerprint cards with loop patterns on it. Well, lo and behold, a day later, he found it. He found the criminal, who was a young offender. And so it shows you, you got to keep your eyes open, but it shows you that once you know the pattern, it's a lot easier to search for it. If you're a fan of the CSI series and the crime movies, when a person is arrested, you'll see them taken back into the station where their mugshots were taken and their fingerprints rolled by the officers in charge of the cells at the station. Now, it makes me laugh every time I see it, because quite often the actors doing the work will take the finger, get it covered in black ink from a pad on the desk, and then just push the fingerprint down onto the paper, which yields absolutely nothing. But we'll talk about that later. If you remember our old friend Bertillon, after the fingerprints are taken, then a picture is taken of the criminal and a description sheet is done. It describes things like scars or tattoos, anything that's unique about him. And if necessary, they'll actually even take photographs of the tattoos, because they're so popular these days that it makes a good database for searching. While we're on the topic of databases, let's talk about the granddaddy of them all. AFIS, or in some countries it's known as IAFIS. AFIS stands for Automated Fingerprint Identification System, and the FBI call theirs Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System. But regardless of who has it, it's a wonderful tool, because you can take a fingerprint that you found at a crime scene, and in the hands of a skilled examiner, they'll put it on a flatbed scanner and they will plot out the different points of comparison. Reading a fingerprint is just like reading a map. We talked about only 8 different patterns existing in the fingerprint world. But if you take a closer look, get a magnifying glass and take a look at what your fingerprints look like under magnification. What you'll see is your friction ridges, and they form in different patterns. So let's take a loop pattern. It's a basic, straightforward pattern where the friction ridge comes up, loops around the center of the finger, and back down again. And it does this in succeeding ridge lines. But what makes this print so unique is the characteristics inside the print itself. So it's like reading a map. If you picture a river, and the river goes along in the country and then splits up into what we call a bifurcation, and then later closes back up again into another bifurcation. So you have, in fact, 3 characteristics there. You've got the beginning of the bifurcation, you have a lake, and then you have the top end of your bifurcation. Other ridge characteristics are things like ridge dots, which is basically just a piece of friction ridge just sitting there on its own, doing nothing. And this is what you look for in your ridge characteristics. Now, genetics, as we talked about before, has already determined the position of these ridge characteristics in the unborn child. And if you can imagine, your own genetics are not the same as anybody else's. So what'll happen is your system, your genetic system, is putting these characteristics in certain locations in those fingerprints. And so when I, as the examiner, go along to compare the fingerprint that I found at a crime scene with the ruled fingerprint pattern of the suspect, I will start looking for characteristics. I'll say, okay, there's a ridge dot, and that's the one in the suspect's prints. And then I'll look at the other one, the suspect fingerprint. And I said, there's another ridge dot, and it's exactly the same place. And you keep going like this. So there's a ridge ending, yep, in the one, ridge ending in the other, yep. Bifurcation in one, yep. Bifurcation in the other one, yep. And you keep going back and forth until you get number of characteristics present in the same spot, in the same set of fingerprints from your suspect and your crime scene. So you can make a determination based on the number of matching characteristics. We used to call it identification due to a succession of ridge characteristics in sequence. Although successful, this process takes a long time, especially if you have a simple pattern like a loop and you have to look through a bunch of suspect inked impressions of a loop and try and match it to your one that you found at the crime scene. Fortunately for law enforcement, a few computer companies decided to take on the task of searching fingerprints using algorithms, measurements. So companies like Cogent, NEC, and PrintTrack design systems where the fingerprint that you found at the crime scene, or an incoming set of fingerprints from a person just arrested, would be put onto the flatbed scanner, and it would be scanned. So the machine would look up the individual characteristics, but it wouldn't see a fingerprint. It would just see a number of different points, and the points, if they matched or if they came close, would be presented to the examiner as the closest number of possibilities to give you a positive identification. So it's still up to the human, it's still up to the human eye to make that positive identification. But it certainly has come a long way in helping us to help solve the crimes that we were tasked to solving. The third topic we're going to be discussing is about evidence collection. So stay tuned for that, and we'll get into how to collect evidence. And then also, the fourth topic we're going to be discussing is crime scene management. So stay tuned.